go no-go and continue stop. Go no-go decisions are hard. The decision to continue a challenging flight or end it is even harder because the pilot's already committed. But there are ways for pilots to make better decisions when the balance between risk and reward isn't obvious.
So Catherine, when a lot of pilots think of go and no-go decisions, they think of personal minimums in order to make those decisions as simple, as objective as possible. What are some of your personal minimums?
Yeah, I think it's good for all of us to review these things. Some typical ones, of course, would involve weather conditions. Now, interestingly, winds and crosswinds, my personal minimums are probably not the most conservative. My home airport usually has a lot of winds and they're usually swirl. So that's something that I keep practice on with regularity. I do that a lot. Whereas one of my sayings is night IFR mountains, pick one of them. So I'll fly at night, but typically I want some nice weather. I'm not going to cross any mountains at night and things like that. So those are some of my personal minimums.
Doug, how about you?
Personal minimums?
Yeah.
What, me?
Yeah.
I've got to say, the longer I fly, the more hours I accrue, the more cautious I get. I will say that. As an example, I drove here. Rather than flying my Super Cruiser, couldn't fly the Cardinal because it's out of service right now. But one of the things that I advocate, and I use it for myself as well, is that it's not only personal minimums. There's so many things that go into the go, no-go decision. I like to kind of use, although I don't have any really formalized FRAT list, but flight risk assessment tool that combines all the different elements of a flight. So maybe I didn't get so much sleep. Okay, well, I'm going to be a little tired, a little fatigue. Maybe there's something going on with the airplane that I'm not exactly satisfied with. Maybe it's going to be nighttime. How long is the flight going to be? I take all these things and kind of put scores to them. And if, let's just say for generalization, you add up all these different elements that you have to consider, your fatigue, all the I'm safe stuff, all your currency, your proficiency, the environment, the weather, the airplane, the external pressures, you give them all scores. It falls between 1 and 10, go, not a problem. It falls between 11 and 20, you better think twice about this. Falls above 20, it's a no-go. And it's a way to objectify that. I know I wish years ago I was aware of that. Save for the grace, I wouldn't be sitting at this table. I've done so many stupid things. So I've become much more cautious, and I use a flight risk assessment tool, such as it is, to help me make that decision.
Yeah, that kind of tool is making sure that you not just look at one factor, but back up and look at the entire mission. And I've thought a lot about this, especially over the last year and a half. About a year and a half ago, I got a call from a guy who's telling me about a crash that had happened out of Gainesville, Georgia. And I went back and I looked at the report, and just the preliminary report alone paints an interesting picture. I don't even want to speculate on what actually caused the crash, but this fellow had a new-to-him airplane, and he took off on an IFR flight. He was cleared to depart on, I think, runway 11, and then was given a turn to the southeast. And about 30 degrees, and he continued through that 30 degrees of heading change, and in IMC went into the ground. But if you look at the preliminary report, he took off in a new-to-him airplane with a new-to-him panel. He had just received his instrument rating a few months before. It was right before night. It was in winter, low IMC with family on board. And if you put all of that together, you think, why on earth, how many yellow and red flags does it take for us to put the plane back in the hangar and exercise a plan B? And what really stung is I knew this fellow, and I had given him his private pilot check ride. And I didn't do his instrument, but I spent many nights staring at the ceiling, wondering, had I missed a hazardous attitude on his private exam that that would have made things turn out differently if I had noticed that then. So I've done a lot of thinking about looking at these risks in concert And we have to, at the end of the day, stand back and wonder if this is a flight that should just, you know, stop and the plane go back into the hangar.
Yeah, I try to take a holistic view of these go, no-go decisions too. But this is a bit of heresy, but it's like personal minimums for me, I don't believe in them. In instrument conditions, let's just limit it to that. For an IFR pilot to take off knowing that he's going to fly an IMC and probably do an approach at the destination, you've got to be qualified and competent to fly that approach to the FAA published minimums, or you should not go. I think that these are silly distinctions to say, well, I'll go if it's 800 but not 600 and the minimums are 400. The weather doesn't care about your personal minimums. You know, the forecasts are unlikely to hit the mark that well. I'll look at things like, are the general trends improving or worsening? I'll try to stack the deck in my favor. But I think we kid ourselves when we set some artificial boundary and say that, well, we'll put our toe in, but we're not going to jump in, or we'll go up to our knees, but not up to our waist. And to me, if you are, you know, anything less than being fully qualified and capable to fly to the published minimums, you should not fly an IMC in those conditions.
Well, here we are again. Number one, I think personal minimums, number one, are not static. Personal minimums change, having a lot to do with your proficiency, with your state of mind, your state of health. The only thing that's static in aviation is that airplane, that old DC-3 hull that's bolted to a pedestal at the entrance to the airport driveway. So personal minimums, number one, are not static. They do change. My personal minimums change. I'll fly when I'm really busy in the middle of the summer and flying approaches virtually every day. If I've got 100 and a quarter, I'm going to go fly. That fits my minimums. However, it's the middle of the winter and I haven't flown an approach in real IMC, my minimums have changed, okay?
Well, you are making my case for me, because it's exactly this type of situational decision-making that makes personal minimums meaningless.
They're not meaningless. It's just that they're not static. You don't make one and say, that's it forever and ever, amen. They change, and we have to recognize that they change. And we also have to recognize hazardous attitudes. And there isn't a person in this building that doesn't have at least one of them. I have all five. And it's taken more than 16,000 hours to get a handle on some of these.
But they change based on how badly you want to go.
Exactly. Doug, if you say that your personal minimums change, then you don't have personal minimums. And I think, because you're willing to change them, and that means that sometimes pressure for a flight can cause them to change too. We know that a lot of corporate operators and military do a risk assessment, and they actually get a score like you spoke about. And I guess that works for them. I'm kind of the PAVE guy. I think about those four things, and if I've got a couple of strikes against me, maybe I shouldn't be going. But I'm comfortable to fly approaches to minimums in most airplanes if I'm familiar with the airplane, not, as you pointed out, Catherine, a pilot getting in an unfamiliar panel. Single-engine airplane, I want 802 for takeoff. If I'm going to have a little crisis right at takeoff, I'd like to be able to make a visual pattern and return and land. Multi-engine airplane, I'm comfortable with published minimums, as long as the PAVE kind of all checks okay.
So, Wally, when you have somebody that comes to you for a check ride, I'm sure you ask the question, what are your personal minimums or something like that? What's your decision-making process, right? Do you expect them to have a minimum that's more conservative than someone with more time?
There's no wrong answer to me on a check ride, at least in my opinion, to that question. Yes, and I do ask the question just to see if they're thinking about it. And most of them, instrument pilots, will say they have, you know, real high new personal minimums. They're telling me that maybe because they think that's what I want to hear. I don't know. But to me, it's not part of the test. That brings up hazardous attitudes. We've mentioned that. I think it would be very rare for an examiner to be able, at least in my case, to be able to identify a hazardous attitude, because when an applicant comes to us, they're the most conservative pilots ever. And I certainly was when I went to examiners to take check rides. So if we see a hazardous attitude in that environment, we really have to be careful.
Well, I think to Doug's point, someone might come to, say, a private pilot check ride and say, my personal crosswind component limit is 10 knots or something like that. Yeah. But I'm going to work towards getting it up to, say, the maximum demonstrated for the airplane. Mm-hmm. But I'm not going to do that in response to a flight I want to make where the wind happens to be such that I would need it to be. right? Mm-hmm. And so that's where, I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, Doug, that's how you would expand those personal minimums. So that's how they would change, right, is through more experience, through training, maybe through an objective third party, like a flight instructor saying, yep, yeah, you're good to go at 12 now.
Right? Certainly that way, but also through my own recognition of my own proficiency. You know, we have currency rules in IFR flying. Currency rules don't mean a goddamn thing to me. Hey, I needed 6 approaches in 6 months, and I did 5 of them 5 months ago, and I did 1 a month ago. You know, legally, I'm current. Am I proficient? Hell no.
Well, and IFR has some of this built in the form of actual minimums on charts and things like that.
I was going to say that I don't find anything wrong with the idea that personal minimums expand and contract, not in response to how badly I need to get to point B, but for my recent proficiency and experience. You know, if I laid off flying for a year and I'd get back in the plane, I think my minimums would naturally become more conservative. They should become more conservative. But as I gain more proficiency, I don't think there's anything wrong with recognizing that I'm capable to make a flight that I wouldn't be if I hadn't taken the time off.
Okay, so let's play this out. So the minimums at your destination are within your limits when you make your go, no-go decision. You fly to your destination, you tune the ATIS, and it's like, okay, now they're 100 feet below. Are you going to execute that approach or are you going to go somewhere else?
Yeah, so actually in that situation, I would execute the approach. When I'm thinking of personal minimums, this is in the context of, am I going to make this flight? And if I thought that I wouldn't be able to get into the destination when I started the flight, I'd probably pick something else to do or pick another destination. But I probably still would do that. And I think there's a distinction between, you know, sometimes we just get curveballs in flight. And I'm going to make sure that I'm as proficient as possible. But, you know, what do we do if we hit a bird, right? We've got to make some decision on the fly. So I really don't think that I'm being inconsistent in saying that my personal minimums will expand and contract.
I'd like to say just yesterday in coming here, okay, all I've got to fly in is my Super Cruiser. I don't have ADS-B. It's not IFR certified. In fact, it's even questionable whether the transponder is current or not. 20 years ago, I would have kicked the tires, light the fire, and said, I can do this. I'm the ace of the base and flown here. Did I like driving here for 2.5 hours? Hell no. But after 16,000 hours, and say for the grace not being here, my personal minimum said flying in those low marginal VFR conditions is not something I will be happy with. And so I drove.
And that was less I have a personal rule where I won't fly in X ceiling. That was a take account of the whole picture and make a decision.
Yeah.
Right.
I think maybe step one for me is I want to enjoy my flight wherever it is I'm going. I don't have a mission anymore that's so important I shouldn't enjoy it. And so if there's something out there that I'm not going to enjoy, then that's an easy decision. It doesn't even involve personal minimums, turbulence, heat.
I agree with that. I mean, also the other thing, I had told Ryan, I said, I will be there at 5 o'clock, whether I drive or I fly. And I realized, well, if I'm willing to wait and delay my departure, it'd probably work out fine. But it also made that, all these things are what, I made that agreement. I'm going to be here at 5 o'clock. But no, and these are the things that go into the decision-making. That's what I'm trying to get to. There are so many different elements.
And that's a great point about external pressure too, right? Because if you could have taken off on that flight and turned around at the first sign of trouble, maybe you would have gone for it, right? But you knew you had to be there and that might have pressured you to make it work. And so yeah, that plays a role, right?
Absolutely. Or I could have said, well, I could have delayed my departure for an hour and a half and it'll work out fine. And it would have. But a commitment I made, and that's part of that decision making.
I would have been very angry.
I was afraid I'd miss a beer.
Well, I know. Yeah.
Back to VFR personal minimums for just a minute, and specifically wind. To me, the crosswind limit depends on where the crosswind landing is going to be. I don't mind a 25 or 30 knot crosswind out in Kansas where it's nice and flat and it's going to be a nice steady wind, but a 30 knot crosswind at Catherine's Airport would certainly be a no-go for me.
One of my more VFR personal minimums actually has to do with aircraft instruments, and in particular, what I'm willing to accept as inoperative. I have very little patience for things that don't work right, so I want everything in my plane to work right. As an examiner, I have to say sometimes I'm really disappointed to get into an airplane that has many, many in-op stickers all over it. And at the end of the day, it's not fun to pay for these things, but there can be a slippery slope. If you're willing to have this inoperative, well, then you're also willing to have something else inoperative. So I'd rather just keep up with it and make sure that everything is working right.
And Doug, you've talked about safety drift, right? That sounds like that.
Mm-hmm. But just becoming complacent. We get away with something, we accept it. Oh, well, that works. Oh, no, this will be okay. Yeah, I can do it. And I'm guilty of it. I'm not going to say anyone in this room is, but I'll speak for myself. I know I'm guilty of it. I've been around long enough and made enough mistakes that I'm a slow learner. What can I tell you? But I'm much more conservative than I used to be.
My conservatism varies between the mission, you know, and I'm more aggressive if it's just me. But on my flight here, I'm traveling with my wife. If I'm traveling with my wife and my kids, I won't, you know, pretend that I could give you a number on some risk chart, you know, but it's like flying is just one elaborate sort of risk reward exercise. You know, what's the risk? What's the reward? and the risk goes way up if you're taking your spouse or your kids or your whole family on board. I'd like to be able to pretend that there's one level of safety, and the truth is there's really not.
Actually, I'm not so sure we disagree very much here. I think we have just a different way of trying to assess backup and assess what this flight means with its rewards and its risks. I think we actually agree more than we think.
So do you ask that question, Catherine, on a private pilot check ride? What are your personal minimums?
I don't frame it that way and use the term personal minimums, but I might, for example, I might have them compute a runway distance, the takeoff distance for our flight that day. And, you know, maybe they come up with that they would need 1,500 feet to clear a 50-foot obstacle. So I might say something like, all right, your runway is 1,600 feet and there's a 50-foot tree on the end. What are your thoughts on that? And, you know, one of the more painful things I hear somebody say is, oh, you know, I'd add about 10%, 20% because I'm new as a pilot. And, you know, I'm glad that they're thinking about adding something. Actually, one of my favorite articles was one of yours, Dave, where you and Richard, I think, took a couple planes out and did the same calculation and then actually went out and flew it with people with tape measures and showed that, if I recall correctly, there's only one time you didn't need 30% more than what the book said. And sometimes it has little to do with our proficiency. And I think the point of that, or you all advocated that folks add at least 50 to 100% for a safety margin in there. And so I point out that this has very little to do with your inexperience as a pilot. It has to do with, gosh, that engine, you know, what happens to our engines when they're not freshly overhauled? They produce less power, yet the same POH is supposed to represent the old tired airplane and the one with the brand new engine. So I want to hear that they have some minimums that make sense and that they've arrived at them in a way that that just makes me feel like they're going to be out there flying for decades to come.
And remind me, Dave, who was the pilot in that video who was the only one that was able to match the book numbers?
Oh, you're trying to embarrass me now? No, I was flying the A36 Bonanza and was able to pretty much stop it in the book numbers, but the takeoff distances were pure fiction, and the 182 was not even close. Even though you know, you've got current proficient excellent pilots flying them. And so I've heard it said lots of times that it's the marketing department that comes up with those numbers. It's not the engineering department. And it's a bitter pill when you make these calculations, and it's shocking when the plane does not live up to them. Why go through this elaborate exercise if at the end we've got to add 50% to the numbers to make it at all realistic? You know, I found that the Part 25 airplanes are a lot more truthful when it comes to the calculated numbers. But, you know, you just want to shout it from the rooftops that it's like, hey, your POH for these Part 91 piston airplanes is made up. You cannot rely upon that.
So once you get going, once you're airborne, you've made the go decision, sometimes the tougher decision then is when to call it off, when to turn around, when to keep going. And you've got all these extra pressures then, especially if it's a longer trip, like, you know, where am I going to stay when I get on the ground? Details like that. How do you go about making good decisions in cases like that and not having the temptation to get sucked into continuing?
It's really tough. We're all goal-oriented people. We want to complete the goal. And it's hard to divert or make a precautionary landing. You know, even in helicopters, you see these VFR into IMC helicopter accidents. And you just think, holy cow, man, you're a helicopter. You can land anywhere. But that desire to get to the location is so strong that you just go. And you just have to recognize that that's going to be your tendency. And you've got to be able to fight and resist that temptation. I've been really disappointed in myself a few times when I passed up viable alternatives to continue. In my mind's eye, I can see some of them. We used to go to these aerobatic competitions in these aerobatic airplanes, VFR only, no gyros. You know, and we're pushing the weather and flying in low ceilings to either to get there for the event or to get home in time to go to work. And Doug was making the point about you get more conservative as you get more experience and the ability to like intentionally make a precautionary landing. Has anyone in this room ever made a precautionary off airport landing? I haven't. You know, and I mean, you might counsel it. You're flying over the open spaces of Iowa somewhere and the weather's getting low. You know, would you? I'd like to be able to say that I would, but I haven't yet.
I will say I've never done a precautionary off-airport landing, but I certainly have many a time. Where's the nearest airport?
Right. But that's not what I'm talking about. But because like your Super Cruiser, you could land that in any pasture,
mm-hmm.
and you haven't. And neither have I.
I haven't had the need yet.
Right. But it's like you probably felt pretty close sometimes. I'm curious because these are the hardest problems that we wrestle with. And when it's really bad and it's an emergency and you've just got to find a place, then that's pretty clear cut. You can do that. But when it's marginal and when it's like, it looks a little bit lighter up ahead. You know, it looks like I think I can see some sunshine on the ground up ahead. Those are the really tough ones.
We talked earlier about analyzing your decisions after you fly, and I just had a recent example of my own bad decision in diversion. I had recently had a little short instructional flight out of Charleston International in a 172. And as we departed, we could see these big black thunderstorms coming from the other direction. So we flew off and did our business, and now we're attempting to race the thunderstorms back. And we're, you know, the guys are landing. We hear guys landing, but you can see it's very black at the airport. And I can see the runway. We're 7 miles out. I really wanted to get back. My car was there. I had things to do after that flight. I had made plans. And pretty soon we hear about a wind shear warning. And like a dummy, I kept coming. I'm looking at that runway, and it just was a magnet. You know, I wanted to be there so bad. And then they started talking about microburst reports. And I kept coming. And, the other guy was flying, and he was kind of a new guy, so he wasn't going to make the decision if I didn't. And I finally turned off at about 4 miles from the airport, still able to see the runway, but the wall of rain was at the other side of the airport. And we returned to the west and landed at an airport, and 2 hours later came back in sunshine. But as I'm driving home, I'm thinking, how stupid was I? I could have made that decision 15 minutes earlier. And I got up way too close to that thing because it was just there. I could see it, and I wanted it bad, and it was a bad decision.
Been there, done that, a very similar thing, trying to get into Hickory, North Carolina. And there were thunderstorms popping left and right. And Atlanta Center was doing their best, but they couldn't keep up with things. There's a Citation ahead of me going in. I'm watching stuff. It's more two eyeballs out the window than using X-ray radar because it was just, the stuff was happening too fast. And the Citation called off the approach and went somewhere else. And I knew where he went, but no. And I'm telling him, we got it. Look, there's the runway right there. There's a cell up over there, but it's kind of heading towards the runway. But we can beat it in. We can beat it in. And then listened to the AWAS, and the winds were gusting right down runway 1, but gusting to 40. And we're already on the base. I said, we'll make this. And when I heard gusting to 40, I said, yeah, we can make it, but what if we don't? There's no going around, because the wall of rain had just gotten to the departure end of the runway. What the hell was I doing? And what did I teach my learner? You know, it's like, look, this ain't working. Let's go where that citation went. And we went there and we hung out there for 3 hours.
In the airline, the decisions are a little more cut and dried, at least I felt. You've got numbers and you just should not violate those numbers. But I did have an interesting experience one time coming, I think it was from Athens or somewhere overseas. We were very tight on fuel for whatever reason. And so as we're coming into JFK, the JFK weather is well above minimums. It's like 1,000 feet or something, but low enough that we had to have an alternate, and our alternate was Newark. And we all know to get busy time to get IFR between Kennedy and Newark is going to take some time. And we had a lot of fuel for that. But we kept coming and thinking if the JFK weather just simply gets a little higher, we can remove the alternate and then we're legal. But if it doesn't, we can't. And I wound up landing at Hartford, 60 miles short. Now, I'd just flown all the way overseas and tried to explain to the passengers that we didn't have enough fuel to go to Kennedy, but was okay to land at Hartford. That's pretty hard to explain. But we didn't get too many letters. I could have either violated the rule, which I wasn't going to do, because all you need is one hiccup now, and now you're in trouble.
Let's talk about scud running. The standard advice is don't scud run, but that's a little bit like saying don't fly in weather you shouldn't fly in, right? It's not particularly helpful. So what counts? Like, what counts as scud running, and why? How do you know if you're scud running and you shouldn't be?
Yeah, I mean, it's to me, it's like, okay, you're below the MSAs and you're maneuvering to avoid clouds and terrain. That's scud running. You know, it's, I don't care exactly what your cloud separation distance is. You know, I think it's hard to tell sometimes, but it's when you have that feeling in the pit of your stomach that I'm looking ahead for obstacles, I'm nervous about what I'm going to encounter, and I'm just trying to make it over the next ridge, then that's scud running. And it's, and more importantly than the definition, is just, it's not a smart or enjoyable place to be as a pilot.
Yeah. If you're looking out the window for obstacles to steer around them, that's maybe a sign that you should call
this. We might
not
be able to define it, but you'll know it when you see it.
Yeah. And when you're scud running, you know, it's often the case that you have a low ceiling, but it's not like the visibility is necessarily great. So you touching on the fact that you're worried. I was in a situation years and years ago where, you know, I was flying along and the ceiling kept creeping down and down and down. And there was that point where I got sort of a pit in my stomach. And so I actually found an airport and landed and made a new plan.
I've actually done that in scenarios with private pilots. As we go off on our little cross country, after they've demonstrated they can navigate, I'll say, well, you're starting to bump into the clouds now. What will you do about that? And they'll go down. And I say, gee, you're bumping into the clouds again right now. What would you do next? And I see how low I can get them. And I've gotten them down to below 1,000 feet. That's not a good decision. But because that's the way it develops, isn't it? Just
right.
Like you said. And at some point, you've got to say, I'm too low now. It's time to go back, time to retreat back to better weather.
You know, it is such an insidious thing. And also, I find that what seems to happen so often is that we'll fly to the worst possible weather and then stop. You know, we'll set it up so that we stack the decks against ourselves, that we think it's going to be pretty good, but it's not good. It's pretty marginal. It's getting worse. And then about the time it gets to its absolute worst is the time that now we're looking for an alternate, or now we're looking to land. It's just striking to me how pilots box ourselves in, where we go to the worst possible low point when we can't go any further, and then we make our choice to land, and we do it in the most difficult conditions that we could possibly find. I was ferrying a Husky from Southwest Alaska to Texas, and big long multi-day trip, and I was over Eastern Oregon. And this is, I guess it was the fall. I think it was over like Pendleton, Oregon, on the way to Baker, Oregon, you know, far eastern Oregon, and mountainous. And, you know, the weather's not supposed to be bad, but it's not good. Then there's some rain, and then there's little snow showers. And I'm sort of in the valley between the ridges. And the next airport is just over the next ridge. So it's like, all right, there's no good place to land in this valley. I've just got to get over the next one where the terrain is lower. It wasn't desperately bad because, you know, this airplane had, if I had to fly it in the clouds, I could. And that was the option. Do I go into these clouds to clear this ridge or not? And so it ended up being, it's like, no, I can just kind of scrape by and visibility is good enough. And I'll stay off the, you know, don't go right over the highway because that's typically where the towers are. So it was able to make it into the next valley. And surprisingly, it's like, now that I'm in the next valley, weather doesn't look quite so bad. And it actually got better after that, and I was able to keep going. And once I got to the alternate, didn't actually have to land there, things got better. But I think that really stands out in my mind because that's the only instance I can remember where you're scud running and you get to the low point and then things improve. Usually it's just a downward trend.
Sometimes you have another option in these cases, which is getting above the clouds. There's a hole you can get through. It's much more comfortable to be cruising on top of the clouds, but then of course you've got to get down below them at some point or on the other side of them. If you're a non-instrument rated pilot, let me put this to you, Wally, although I know you are an instrument rated pilot, pretend that you're not. Is that ever okay for a VFR only pilot to fly on top of, say, an overcast cloud layer in order to get to the other side of it?
If you have assurance that you're going to get broken or scattered clouds on the other side, I'm not sure how far the other side is in this example, but if it's not too far, sure. I don't see that as a terrible risk at all. I don't know how the rest of the group feel. But.
Well, the answer is it depends.
Yeah.
I remember as a low time pilot coming back from, I think it was at Montauk and going back to Great Barrington and coming across Long Island Sound, the clouds were there as kind of marine layer. And I'd already checked the weather before I left and I knew that Albany was VFR. And my choice was, well, do I go below these? I don't think so. That's not going to be good. And I'd come down, was below them. I did a 180 till I got past, climbed up over on top, and knew that if it didn't clear up by Great Barrington, and I had fat on fuel, so I didn't have to worry. If I had to, I'd go beyond Great Barrington, get to Albany, and come back down under it, and then come back. That way it works.
Yeah, I think that's the key. If you've got a guaranteed I can get below it at XYZ, then I think it's a reasonable risk. If you say, I hope it breaks up, that's not a reasonable risk.
Right. I mean, there is the risk if the engine quits, yeah. What are you going to do when you've got a solid layer under you? Mm-hmm. But there are stories of pilots who, you know, get up over it to get there, and the tops keep climbing, and there are no holes, mm-hmm. and they don't have oxygen, and...
Yeah, I was on an IFR flight listening just on the radio, and I hear this pilot checking in. Hey, I'm VFR at 17.5, like to climb to 18.5 to get above the clouds. And he's in like a 182. And I was thinking, wow, I'm flying on this day, and it's a pretty challenging day no matter what you're in. And, you know, the controller asked him, that's your way up there. You got oxygen up there? And he's like, no, but I'm feeling okay. Just need to get up, just need to clear this next bunch of clouds. And can I get up above 18, you know, VFR? Yeah. And we all know you got to be on an IFR flight plan above that altitude. So, you know, they had to sort of negotiate this. Are you declaring an emergency? You know, and they got through it evidently because I never heard. I checked the accident reports the next day. I had to change frequency so I didn't get to hear how it ended. But, we will put ourselves in some tight spots. I remember ferrying a steerman who was going from Minnesota to Florida in the wintertime. And I was crossing, you know, I thought the hard part of the trip was going to be the northern plains because it was so darn cold. But that was nice and clear. When I got to, it was over Alabama. Weather was worse than forecast. It's surprisingly hilly down there in northern Alabama. Going above the clouds thinking that I could get to my destination because the destination's VMC. And I spent the entire flight in beautiful blue sky above this undercast, just praying that I would get, because this is kind of the end of my range. And I remember I must have been about 25 miles out from Tallahassee was my destination. And I'm just above this solid undercast and I'm tuning the ATIS at Tallahassee and it says clear in a million. And sure enough, you know, it was less than 5 miles from the airport is where this undercast ended and got to watch the sunset and land in beautiful conditions. You know, I felt like I definitely used up one of my silver bullets on that one. And the main thing that sticks with me is just the feeling of I never want to be in this position again. You know, I've got the minimal instrumentation. If I had to land, I'm not sure that I could keep it upright. I think hopefully we live and learn, and that one stands out in my mind as a time when you just feel horribly exposed, and you get to live with that decision for, you know, 2 or 3 hours while you're waiting to while you're waiting for this situation to resolve itself, and you don't have any more cards to play.
Yeah, that's a situation I just don't want to be in without the ability to file an IFR flight plan in my back pocket.
Does it make any difference if you, say, have a good autopilot? Let's say you're this non-instrument rated pilot again. You're flying above an undercast. You have no intention of flying through it, but you never know if it doesn't clear up when you get to your destination or something like that. You might have to, but you have no intention to. But, you know, you have an autopilot that you could use in an emergency to descend through the clouds. Does that change the process at all?
It should not change your decision making. Yeah, certainly you would use the autopilot if you got stuck and needed it, I think, assuming you knew how to use it properly. But I don't think you should say, well, I've got an autopilot, so I'm going to stretch this more than I would without it. That's my view.
We had a horrible accident in Great Barrington many years ago. It was right at the end of spring break, and we'd had a cold front come through, and it was gusty, and there were low clouds and everything. And I came into the airport in the morning, and there was all this commotion. What's going on? Well, there's an airplane we think came into here last night, but it's not here now, and there's an ALNOT on it, alert notice, you know. And they were hunting and hunting. Civil Air Patrol was hunting and hunting and hunting and everything. They finally found the airplane. It was on a direct line from Great Barrington to the Chester VOR, where he ran into Mount Wilcox. It was a family. The rest of the story came out that they were coming home from spring break. Kids' school started the next day. They knew the weather was going to be bad. They were trying to go to Keene. They diverted to Great Barrington, landed, but the office was closed, and there was no outside phone. There was no payphone outside. They hung out there a while and then took off again into icing conditions, amongst other things. Family had known that the wife had called, and they could have gone up somewhere towards Binghamton and been fine, okay? But instead, they tried to go out and hit the top of this mountain. 3 of the kids lived, 2 were killed. They were able to, helicopters airlifted them out. There was a lot of snow on the ground. The mother was killed. The father was taken out on a snowmobile for some reason. I was there at the airport when they brought him from one ambulance to the other, and they stopped because he died right there on the ramp. This was a pretty tough thing for me to deal with. Later in the day, I got a call from a flight instructor from Keene, and very concerned. He said, I gave that pilot a flight review. Am I in any trouble? And I said, well, you know, did you document what you did on the flight review? He said, yes, I do. He said, the problem is this pilot made a habit out of departing Keene in IMC conditions and saying it's not a problem because I'm going to turn on the autopilot. And he probably turned on the autopilot right into the top of the mountain.
Yeah. My home airport is right atop a plateau that rises pretty steeply from the valley just a couple miles away. And we've had a number of folks just fly right into the side of the plateau because they're scud running. So I think that made an impact on me pretty early on. And I'm not interested in anything close to scud running where you have that feeling inside that you know you're not in a safe situation.
On the subject of autopilots, I think they're tremendous safety tools. I mean, using it in a situation in which you can't hand fly or aren't proficient to hand fly is an obvious mistake. But I know that my thinking on autopilots has changed quite a lot over the years. And I used to think that, you know, they're crutches for weak pilots that don't have any attention span. But now in my personal plane, I have an RV4 and it's IFR equipped. And it's got a autopilot. And the autopilot, to me, is a no-go item for IFR. If it's not working, then I'm not going. Because it's, you know, the airplane is just, it's light on the controls. I'm going to bust an altitude. The approach phase is actually not bad. You know, hand flying an approach is pretty straightforward. But during the en route phase, you look away and you're 30 degrees off heading and you're a couple hundred feet off your altitude. And to thoughtfully fly IFR where you're looking at changing conditions and you're considering alternates and you're doing all the things that you should do, I could not fly that reliably single pilot IFR. So the autopilot is essential for IFR in that airplane.
I agree 100%. And a lot of my seminars, I have a big group of IFR pilots out there. And so how many of you are still flying without an autopilot? And some hands go up and I say, come see me at the end of the seminar. I've got some really great therapists I'd like to recommend for you. To fly single pilot IFR without an autopilot, I think is just foolhardy.
So let's say, despite your best efforts, you didn't want a scud run, but you found yourself in the situation where weather's really marginal and you've just got to get a little farther to this airport, right? You're just in it now. What are some tips, Dave? It sounds like you've been in this situation a couple of times. How do you actually...
Who's our expert scud runner?
How do you fly differently in that situation?
Yeah, and there are some... that's a situation no one wants to be in, as you pointed out, but there are some things to improve your odds. And the first one is just slow down. You can slow the airplane down, to put the gear down, deploy the flaps, configure the airplane that it's nice and stable and gives you the best forward visibility and the longest time to avoid an obstacle if there's one in your path. There are some other things that you can do. If you're going to follow a river, you can follow it downstream because the odds are you're going, the water knows where the lower elevation is. Avoid major roads because that's where you're most likely to encounter towers and obstacles that are hard, maybe impossible to see.
But if you're right over top of that road, you won't hit those.
That's true, because if you're right over the pavement, possibly.
Mm-hmm, correct.
But if it's a divided highway and maybe there's one right in the middle, it's
and around it's, me there are power lines that cross from one side of the road to the other in many, many places.
Right.
So
I mean, there's sort of desperation things to do, but there's still cards you can play.
Would you want things like terrain displays and synthetic vision on in front of you, or is that too heads down in that moment?
No, I think that they're tremendously helpful for situational awareness. And if you find yourself in a situation where you're trying to pick your way to the next valley or through the next valley, those sorts of displays can be tremendously useful.
If you've got it, certainly use it. I'm not advocating that, I'm going to go out, I can go scud run because I've got hazard advisor on my foreflight. No, I'm not advocating that. But if I am stuck in that situation, you'd be a fool not to use the equipment if you have it.
I remember flying one of the early Carbon Cubs that had a Garmin G3X primary flight display, MFD, and it's got moving map with terrain and a wind arrow. And I was just thinking, this is complete overkill. This is a cub, for goodness sake. Why do you need all this fancy stuff in this very basic backcountry airplane? But then on that same trip, where it was in the mountains of Idaho, and that all that stuff was coming in really useful. It's like, I can identify this river. I can see where it's going. I can see that it's on the display that it's VFR around the next bend. I can see which direction the wind is blowing at altitude. And so I can see where I'd be most likely to encounter turbulence or thunderstorms. That really convinced me that these sort of high-end, fancy gadgetry can be really useful even in a low and slow airplane like a Cub.
It's a good point. I had never thought about that. I came to the same conclusion about gadgets in a backcountry airplane, Yeah, it could be useful.